Blog Talk Radio.
I'm terribly sorry, sir, but your credit card
your
has
been declined. Your unemployment benefits ran out 2 weeks ago.
What do you mean I'm overdrawn?
2 weeks ago.
I have checks left. Checks
2 weeks
left.
Ago.
Too much month left over at the end of the money? Bad credit holding you back? Want to become a real estate investor but haven't won the lottery? Learn how to fix your credit. Get out of debt and build true financial independence with real estate in 2 hours a week. Tune in to Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio. She'll show you how, without winning the lottery or working 10 jobs. And here's your host, Heather Wagenhall.
Welcome to the broadcast. You are listening to Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio. And for this Saturday, March 20th, 2010, we have a bittersweet episode for you this week. Thank you all for joining us. For those of you who are joining us for the first time, welcome to the broadcast. And we broadcast the Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio Show every Saturday at 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time and 10 a.m. Pacific Standard Time on Wednesdays. We bring you the midweek update, and we talk about crisis management and financial wellness tools designed to help everyone, man, woman, and child alike, manage their finances and attitudes for the single purpose of achieving financial independence. And this, we're almost done with this season. I can't believe it. We're at practicing the three R's: review, revise, and recommit. And we only have one more key left after this. I mentioned that this is a bittersweet episode this week because the ever-popular, effervescent, always good-looking, intelligent, and super fabulous Karen Gurm, our show producer, our e-zine editor, and our chat room moderator, is leaving us for greener pastures by way of San Francisco. So if you are not typically a chat room chatter, I would become one today and pop in and tell Karen how much you're going to miss her and her News by the Numbers update every week. And just say hi. It's been an incredible ride this past year, and we are where we are today at the Unlock Your Foundation as a direct result of her commitment and passions and efforts to help create financial literacy for everyone. So I'm very, very sad to be losing her, but I know she's following her passion to become the greatest PR person ever, and I know that she was for us. She's garnered us an incredible amount of exposure. And as a result of her efforts, a lot of the recognition and awards that we have received have been directly related to her commitment. So I'm very grateful for all that she's done, and I'm terribly sad for the fact that she's leaving us. But I'm excited for her following her dream. And she's signing on with a big PR agency, so hopefully everything that she's looking for she'll find there. And if not, she knows that she will always have a home here at the Unlock Your Wealth Foundation. Now, today's episode is all about review, revise, and recommit. And this is where dieting and budgeting tend to fail for people. And this is why this key is so important. And we're going to be talking about that in the second hour, along with our Unlock Your Wealth protege, Stephen Light, who will be joining us. And we're going to check in with him on his path to financial independence and see how things have matured for him. And in the first hour, in addition to fabulous Minutes on Your Money and our Millionaire Minute, we also have Ken Beasley joining us for our Investor's Edge. He is a major real estate investor and author of the new book, The Real Estate Market Sucks, Now What? I love that title. How great. So he's going to be joining us a little bit later in this first hour to talk about the real estate market and its woes, ups and downs, and how you can profit no matter what the market is doing. So that's always a bonus. I also have some fabulous news for those of you who are not eZine subscribers. You do not know this yet, but you can become an eZine subscriber very simply. If you're listening from the Log Talk Radio show page, just scroll down to the bottom and drop your email address in the subscription box, and you too can become a subscriber for the eZine. You can also send us an email at ezine@unlockyourwealth.com. That's E-Z-I-N-E at unlockyourwealth.com and say sign me up. Or if you just go to our show page and become a member of the show, you will be automatically subscribed to it. So we have a fabulous form for you to fill out. And make sure that you type in your email address. We had some people sign up for the show last week but forgot their email address, and I don't know why the field didn't require it before submission. But nonetheless, please sign up if you are interested in news, tips, tricks, and information to help you along your path to financial independence. You get a lot of good things like the trivia question before everybody else gets it on the actual broadcast, and we'll be talking about that coming up shortly. But first, I'm so excited. I have been asked to participate in a book with Dr. Warren Bennis, and unfortunately, the business philosopher who just recently passed, the late Jim Rohn. And I was fortunate enough to be selected to participate in this anthology that they created. And I've written a chapter in this book on self-empowerment. So the title of the book is Yes, You Can, Reaching Your Potential While Achieving Greatness. And it's pretty amazing. If you surf on over to the website later on today, you will be able to find in our bookstore, you can pre-order this book. It should be out in a couple of months. They're saying 6 to 8 weeks. I don't know exactly. I haven't received my shipping tracking number. So as soon as I have that, I'll be able to tell you. But why don't you order it before you could buy it in stores? And that way, it'll be hot off the presses. If you order it directly from our website versus other booksellers, your copy from me personally will be signed for you. And if you would like your copy personalized, please, when you submit for your pre-order, make sure you put the person's name, if it is not you, that you would like to have this gift personalized for, and I would be happy to personalize it for you and any of your family members and send it off. So, again, thank you so much for listening to this broadcast. And to add to what we talk about every day, you'll really enjoy this chapter. Just ask the illustrious and ever popular Karen Gurm in the chat room, because she was the one who helped to shape the content and edit it to make it look so fabulous. So anyhow, if you're interested in a copy of the book, just surf over the website, and of course it'll always be personalized if you order it direct from us. So be sure to say who you want it personalized to if it's somebody other than yourself. Otherwise, it'll be personalized to you. So for the trivia question from this week's eZine, on the midweek update, we talked about the world's richest men and women. And your trivia question is, who is the world's wealthiest man? Now, you can win one of three ways. You can call in to win at 1-718-508-9002, 718-508-9002. Or if you are hanging out with Karen in the chat room, you can chat in to win. She is moderating the chat room today. So if you think you have the answer, go ahead and type it in. Or sometimes we actually don't get an answer or a correct answer during the broadcast. So if you're listening to this as an archive, always send us an email to trivia@unlockyourwealth.com, trivia@unlockyourwealth.com if you think you know the answer. You can win fabulous prizes. We have all sorts of stuff to give away. We have the best of Volume 1 and Volume 2 in CD form with all of the top picks from Karen, who from interviews from our previous episodes. It's hours of music, It's hours of interviews without any of the other stuff. So if you just want to get to the good stuff, get to the empowering interviews that we have done on this broadcast over the last year, that's the way to do it. And then you can skip all the other stuff and go straight to the source of all these great books and tools. Also, you can choose a book from our fabulous library of autographed books from our previous show guests. You can also win financial coaching, free credit report review. You can also win identity theft protection, all sorts of great things you can have for the low, low price of answering the trivia question. And again, if you want to get ahead of the game and have the trivia question before everybody hears it on the show, all you have to do is simply subscribe to the eZine. eZine at unlockyourwealth.com, or scroll down to the bottom of our Blog Talk Radio show page or at our website, www.unlockyourwealth.com, and submit your information, and you too will be added to the eZine subscription list. So let's get to some minutes on your money, shall we? How about teaching your children the value of money? Sounds like a winner, especially because sometimes that's part of our downfall, our weaknesses when it comes to our children and having to give them what we felt like we didn't have to the detriment of our finances. So this article from Yahoo.com says, teach your children the value of money by starting, one, teaching them reading, writing, and arithmetic. Too bad that list doesn't include personal finance, but most kids learn the basics of money and making change in grammar school, but probably won't learn how to manage money unless they choose finance as a career path. This means it's all up to all of us to see that our children reach adulthood and that are prepared to face life's fiscal challenges. Number two, earlier is better. The benefits of teaching your children about money early are on both immediate and long-term lists of things to do. In the short term, they may develop strong savings habits, learning how to make smart purchases, beginning to understand the true meaning of investment, and perhaps even learn why they can't immediately get everything they want. In the long term, you can help them avoid accumulating debt, and by teaching the value of saving for the future, you can help them plan for financial security. As you think about how, what, and when to teach your children, consider letting them direct you by using their natural inquisitiveness. And remember, it's never too late to start teaching. Even adults can be taught the basics of personal finance. That's like the foundation of our radio show. It's never too late to learn, and it's so important to get started and not worry that you're an adult when you do. Number three, how about teaching them where does money come from? An ideal time to begin teaching your children about the basics of money is when they first begin to notice it. In a child's world, money comes from mom and dad's pockets. And when mom and dad are tapped, a machine magically spits out dollars after merely pushing a few buttons. It's natural for them to assume that money is readily available whenever it is needed. When they can't understand why you can't meet their every demand, you're about to start using the standby response, such as money doesn't grow on trees. I know, I heard that one. But remember, that is a more constructive explanation that may serve both of you better. Every young child, and even very young children, can begin to understand the concept of earning money. Explain to your children that money is earned by working and that you can only spend what you earn. To help them understand what it's like to get paid on a schedule, begin paying them allowance. Then help them set goals for how they spend and save their allowance. It's important, however, to make sure that you stick to the payment schedule. Otherwise, the lessons may be lost. Number four, children and allowances. Experts differ on whether or not allowances should be tied to household chores. Although many people say children will learn more about personal responsibility if they are not paid for pitching in around the home, and others feel it teaches them valuable lessons about working and earning. What you might consider paying your children for are chores outside of their daily duties, such as helping to garden or wash the family car. And I like that. I don't think you should get paid for doing something that you should be as part of a contribution to your family. Everybody has their own roles, and I think that that's great advice. Paying them for something outside what they're expected to do as a contributor. Number five, make saving interesting. You hear it every time you walk by a toy store, I want, or buy me this. Again, pause and take a moment before responding. This situation presents a great opportunity to teach another important lesson about personal finance, savings and interest. Explain that people often save their money for items that they want to buy. A simple lesson involves using a piggy bank, shoebox, or empty peanut butter jar. Make the lesson fun by having your children decorate the bank while explaining to them how you use a real bank to save your money. Encourage your children to save a portion of their allowance for a special goal. As they save money, you might reward them with a small additional amount, just like a bank pays interest. At the end of each month, calculate how much they have saved and then chip in a certain percentage as interest. Last, to further encourage the learning process, you might consider plotting a visual chart of their savings with their goal on the chart as well so they can see how their savings grow. Remember to keep it simple as possible, geared toward each child's level of understanding. That's a phenomenal idea. Number six, banking and investing. Once your children have been saving enough to accumulate $10 or $20, take them to the bank to open their first savings account. Most community banks will allow children to open their first accounts with low minimum deposits. Some even have accounts especially marketed to kids to make the learning process fun. Make sure that your child receives a passbook so they can see the progress of their savings efforts as well as the interest that accrues. Once your children have mastered banking with an institution, you can be then teaching them about investing. When your child wants something they can't quite afford, discuss the value of saving versus borrowing. And if you do extend credit, use a written IOU, establish a repayment schedule, and charge interest. By doing this, you establish the framework for teaching your children that bonds and certificates of deposits are IOUs representing the loans from investors to institutions. Number seven, compounding. This is my favorite, compounding. As your children get older and perhaps take on part-time jobs to earn more money, their savings will likely amass at a quicker rate. Now it is time to review the lesson of compounding, or the ability of earnings to build upon themselves. Explain how compounding can be more dramatic over time the longer money is left alone, the greater the effect will be. This can lead into a discussion about investing and how certain investments can have a greater ability to compound over time. Giving a gift of stocks of well-established or kid-oriented companies can be ideal ways to teach kids about investing. Jerry's, Disney, or Toys R Us, some companies even have shareholder meetings dedicated to children. Mutual funds may be good vehicles as well. Like banks, some fund companies have specific programs to teach children about investing. Often, such funds have low initial investments as well as marketing materials designed to make the investing process fun. Number eight, a little learning can pay off. Teaching your children about the complex financial system may seem daunting, but you can help put your child on the right track by encouraging smart habits now. Is it worth your time and effort to help your children to learn about money? As Benjamin Franklin once said, an investment in knowledge always pays the best dividends. Answering your child's questions honestly and in terms they'll understand can help them begin life on a sound financial footing. So the benefits of teaching your children about money can be both short and long term. Let your children help you determine how you teach them and use their questions to develop lessons. Explore to children and explain to children that money is earned, and consider paying them for helping with certain chores outside of their regular familial obligations. Use a piggy bank, take your kids to the bank, show them how to invest. If they borrow money to buy items, charge them interest. I mean, this is just so great. What awesome information to help with your kids. How about the most and least expensive vehicles to insure? From the New York Times, Jennifer Sarnow Schultz writes, the Porsche Carrera 911 GT two-door coupe is the most expensive 2010 vehicle to insure, according to the new ranking of average premiums for 2010 models that Insure.com released this week. The rankings, which the insurance information shopping site publishes annually, are based on the premium that a 40-year-old man with a good driving record and good credit record and a 12-mile commute would pay annually. I just lost my place. I looked up for a second. The insurance data firm Quadrant Information Services calculated the average premiums for Insure.com by averaging car insurance rates from six large carriers across 10 zip codes in each state. According to the national average premium, the Porsche 911 Carrera GT2 is almost $3,000. And other high-end sports cars like Dodge Viper tend to dominate the list of most expensive premiums. Amy Dana, senior manager, managing editor at Insure.com, says the results didn't surprise her since insurance policies are based on claims histories. The Porsche would have a really high claims history, meaning the drivers that have that model submitted a lot of very expensive claims. They crash a lot, and the cars could be very expensive to repair. So, meanwhile, at the other end of the spectrum, minivans dominated the list of those least expensive to insure. And you should see this chart that they have. Some of the five least expensive: Mazda Tribute, Honda Odyssey, Mazda Tribute 1, Chrysler Town & Country, Jeep Wrangler, and if you'd like to know the top five, Porsche 911, Mercedes S65 AMG, Dodge Viper's number three, the Porsche Pan America Turbo, that's that new four-door Porsche that they've got, it's pretty slick-looking, and then the Dodge Viper Convertible rounds out that top five. How about the 10 best places for second homes? I teased you with this on Wednesday, but couldn't quite get the article out for you. Now, at long last, this is by Stephen M. Sears from Barron's. He says, the price of luxury real estate is starting to rise, and as bargain hunters swoop in, some of the best deals are in second homes with prices as much as 40% off. So, where should you go? To help you in the hunt, Barron's has selected the 10 best places in America for second homes. These alluring locales have it all: gorgeous houses, spectacular views, world-class golf, fishing, skiing, fine dining, and great shopping. You'll find a complete range of lifestyles from peaceful and easy to vigorously social. Some warnings: our selections are every bit as subjective as tastes in homes themselves. They said that the prices cited are mainly based on conversations with locals because hard data really isn't available, and that the plush new retreat may take some time to rise in value, but serious appreciation will require a better economy and quite possibly another big rally in stocks. But, hey, you could do worse. So, number one, Maui, consistently rated the best island in the world by travel experts. This Hawaiian beauty underwent a growth spurt during the past decade that some critics bemoaned as being excessive. But the southern coast, anchored by the hamlet of Wailea, has weathered it all well. One of the first master plan resort communities in the nation, it is a balanced blend of understated gated communities, luxury resort hotels, three excellent golf courses, a tennis center, and, of course, several crescent sandy beaches. How about Kiawa Island in South Carolina? Languid elegance defines South Carolina's coast, and Kiawa, just off Charleston, may be its ideal expression. The island has only one developer. Hold on, I have to flip my article. And an architectural review board that protects the 4,500 or so properties from the excess often seen when wealth meets water. It has 10 miles of hard sand beaches and abundant wildlife, bobcats, gray foxes, loggerhead turtles, and more. Its ocean course has long been the favorite of golfers, and it hosted the 2007 Senior PGA Championship. Want to tee up some culture? Charleston is just 45 minutes away. And how about everybody's favorite place, the Hamptons? Number three, long favorite is the retreat of high-powered New Yorkers. The Hamptons are just now experiencing a fresh jump in home sales, realty brokers say. Credit the revival in Wall Street bonuses. Southampton, a bastion of old money, is now for its grand estates, but lovely homes can be found in what long ago were just potato fields. Park City, Utah is number four, and, oh, it looks like we have a caller. I wonder if that person is answering trivia. Skiers love Park City for its powdery winters, but homeowners relish the summers too. The crowds thin out, life slows down, and the tall aspens lining the nearby Wasatch Range shimmer in the breeze. Aspen, Colorado is number five. Aspen isn't just a year-round playground. It's also a cultural oasis. The home to the Aspen Institute think tank, a world-class symphony and dance and art festivals. The four major ski hills speak for themselves, and the Maroon Creek Country Club includes a challenging course designed by Tom Fazio. The city's west end has a mix of 19th century Victorians and modern abodes not far from the beachfront downtown neighborhoods within walking distance of the lifts. How about Pebble Beach, California? Golfer Jack Nicklaus once said that he had one last round to play for before he died. It would be at Pebble Beach. Number seven is Palm Beach. The Florida island hovers above reality at $30 million plus dollars. So do its finest pads. Captiva in Sanibel Island is number eight. Asheville, North Carolina, nestled among the mountains of North Carolina, Asheville offers a Four Seasons lifestyle with just enough culture and good restaurants to keep urban withdrawal pangs at bay. And guess what? That's where our Unlock Your Wealth protege is from, Asheville, North Carolina. Gasparilla Island, Florida, rounds out our top ten. Katherine Hepburn used to rent a beach house here, and it's easy to see why. The small island off Florida's southwest coast has been lovingly preserved. The Gasparilla Act, a state law passed in 1980, put a tight lid on population density, building heights, and commercial development. Golf carts and some customized to resemble 57 Chevys are the favored mode of transportation. The historic downtown has gracious homes, and the waters around the island are renowned for tarpon fishing. So if you want to check it out, just check in to the Gasparilla Inn. Sounds like sarsaparilla, my favorite drink. And that's your minutes on your money for today. For our Investor's Edge segment, I am so excited to have Ken Beasley joining us today. Ken has been active in the real estate industry for the last 30 years. Mr. Beasley has owned a title and escrow company in Northern Nevada from 1975 through 1984. Currently, Mr. Beasley holds a real estate broker's license in both California and Nevada and has participated in over 5,000 transactions, ranging from joint ownerships, lease option conversions, contracts of sale, short sales, foreclosures, bankruptcies, 1031 exchanges, and conventional real estate. At the time, currently, Mr. Beasley is an active exchange consultant, real estate broker, and published author. His first book was Understanding and Using the 1031 Tax Exchange Process, published in 1996 and now revised in 2005. And today he's going to join us and talk about his new book, The Real Estate Market Sucks, So Now What? He's been a senior instructor for Big Ten seminars in Nevada and consulted with Law Seminars International as an instructor. The companies owned by his organization are Equity Share Realty, Equity Share Funding, Equity Share Plus, Network Foreclosure, and Network Exchange. I wonder if those are negative equity. Now, I wonder if they call it that now that the market has turned upside down. Anyway, born in Chemainus, British Columbia, Canada, and currently hailing from Alamo, California, let's welcome Ken. Ken, welcome to the broadcast.
Hi, how are you doing?
I am well, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing great. And right now, I live in New York right now, so it's a beautiful day, about 70 degrees.
Oh, nice. I love New York. I really enjoy being there. If I would have went there when I was 18, when I had planned to go there, I don't think I would have ever come home. But after, I didn't get there until 10 years later, and I had already established myself here professionally and couldn't find the heart to pull myself away. But boy, do I love New York.
Yeah, it's a great city. I've been here 6 months, and it's been terrific.
Well, I love the title of your book, The Real Estate Market Sucks, Now What? For our company, it doesn't suck for us. We're going gangbusters, but, you know, I have been, you know, gearing for this for several years and gearing my agents and my clients for what has happened because I saw it so long ago, and we prepared for it. So we're having a heyday, but for everybody else, why does the real estate market suck?
Well, I think you hit the nail right on the head. If you planned for it and you had the expertise, and in your case, you knew that in a down market, if you've been in the business long enough, you've gone through good times and bad times. Probably, you would probably agree, never to this degree that have I seen it in 25, 30 years, because it would fall 5%, 6%, go back up 5%, 10% over a period of 5 to 7 year cycles. I've never seen the real estate market go down 30, 40, 50% in some parts of the country. And it really didn't give any room for people to recover, especially when they got in 2004, 2005, 2006 on loans that they really didn't put any money down anyways. They probably weren't qualified for the properties they were getting into. And when a house that they purchased at $500,000 went down to, from $500,000 down to $290,000, there's no recovery. It's going to take 20 years before that'll come back up even to maybe what the loan balance is. So a lot of people just said, hey, you know what, I'm not worried about credit anymore. I'm going to walk from the property. And
strategic defaults is what's leading this market right now.
Yeah, and supply and demand. There's so much product on the market and not enough buyers. And they're trying to stimulate the economy by getting people to buy, by doing everything they can to give credits. But the problem is that the lenders are not lending still on a regular basis. FHAs and certain programs are out there, but overall they're not lending like they should be.
Well, that's what precipitated our current real estate market. All the other ups and downs we experienced outside of what happened with the RTC, was all, market related and supply and demand related. But this has everything to do with the supply of money.
Yeah, and 100% right.
Yeah, so that's why this is more devastating. And I predicted it on this show in 2004 that this was what was to come, because I was in mortgages at the time, and I saw it coming. And that's how I wrote my Keys to Riches program as an alternative to taking subprime loans. And you know what? I said, look, you can tweak your credit. We can pay down some debt. We can restructure some things here and get you a great loan where you could buy much more than if you take this crappy subprime loan. And back when I wrote the strategy, a smoking deal on a 30-year fixed rate loan in the 90s was 9.5%. So when you got into double digits on the subprimes, it made sense. But after 9/11 and the interest rates went so low that even a crappy loan, when everybody else was getting 4.5 on a good one, a crappy loan was 6.5 or 7. That was still a great property for a lot of people.
Well, and like you said, 6.5, 7% was a good loan, and especially if you would have put some money down to begin with. But the problem was that the prices were going up so fast from about 2004 to 2006 that people were using their homes like ATM machines. And you'd see.
I've always said that.
Yeah, and it just got out of hand, and the lenders really fueled it.
I think that the general consumer works hand in hand with the lender. I won't throw the lender under the bus, because I wouldn't do those loans. And I didn't make near as much money when interest rates went down as I did when interest rates were higher, because I couldn't bring myself to do that. I couldn't bring myself, because everybody just, gimme, gimme, gimme. And I had a hard time with saying, but you don't understand, the first rate adjustment on this loan could be 6%, because, you could go straight to your max cap on some of those subprime loans where they were fixed for 3 or 5 years,
right.
And then they would adjust up, and your first adjustment had an annual cap of 6 on the first adjustment. So you're going to go from 6 to 12?
Well, see, in one. You had to explain that as a lender. You should explain that to everybody, but most of the people were buying in sound bites of 3 to 5 years, thinking, well, the worst scenario if I buy this house, because they had already looked at the market and said, this house was worth $300,000, now it's $380,000 in a matter of a year and a half, 2 years. So if I get in at $380,000, and even if my adjustable rates go up a little bit and I hold on to it for 3 years and get rid of it, not thinking about the decline in the real estate market, I'm still going to come out ahead.
They were maxing their ratios at that level. There was no way they could have afforded that adjustment.
No. And I think that's the problem is a lot of them got into it thinking, well, rather than rent, here's a chance to invest, get some tax benefits, and then turn around and make some money off of an investment.
Yeah, well,
it went down fast. It went down very fast.
The lenders would not have done the deals had not the customer asked for that product. It's an incestuous little deal. You can't just throw those evil lenders under. If there wasn't a demand in the marketplace for those types of loans, nobody would have written them.
You know, I think in some ways, and you're right about that, I think back in the 90s, and I'm not Democrats, Republicans, I don't care about the political agenda there, but I think in the 90s, the government and the president and the parties said, okay, let's have everybody be able to afford home ownership. And to do that, they implemented programs that really brought the qualifications down for people to have a chance at home ownership. And I think a lot of that snowballed into where the lenders came up with programs that they were instructed to do certain ways, and then it just snowballed into a bad direction because people were getting in over their heads. People were getting in that they really didn't qualify for the loan, or it was a no-income type loan, or when they're self-employed. So at some point, there was no qualification standard that made sense to owning a property. You know, it just didn't make sense.
Well, with what's going on in the marketplace, tell us what made you write this book first.
Well,
why don't we do that?
It was out of anger. It really was out of anger. From 1999, I put so many people into homes, and one of the programs I had was people, in order to get into a home, needed some help, especially in the California area where prices kept going up, and probably only 30% of the people were able to acquire home ownership. So I started a equity share or joint ownership program where people, and it started off with parents and kids, you know, helping their kids out. You had a little segment just before, and it worked out wonderfully where parents would put part of the down payment down and the kids would move into the house, and there was a joint ownership between them. And it went on for 3, 5, 7, 8, 10 years, and I did this a lot of times with parents and kids, and then investors out of IRAs, out of 1031 exchanges, said rather than invest in a big property, let's buy into a property where somebody is going to actually make the payments and we can be the investor part of it to a half interest, whatever. So I helped a lot of people get into homes, and that went very well up till 2006, 2007. The problem was as time went on and lenders came to me that said, hey, I have a client, can you help them out maybe with an investor going in with them or whatever to put 10% down or whatever. We didn't do 3% down, 10 to 20% down is what we were doing. So we were doing that right. But what happened, a lot of these lenders, even though we tried to underwrite them and make sure the people qualified because we didn't know who the people were other than getting them into the property, we found out that the lenders were cutting corners. And so I hired my own underwriter to just look at everything. Unfortunately, I went into areas like the Sacramento area and areas out of my realm of the East Bay, and then I went into parts of Nevada where I'm a broker and other areas. And by losing control of the quality of the product and not knowing, you know, the areas as well, I realized when things started turning downward that some of these people weren't really qualified to get into the houses. So I tried to save a lot of the houses for them and tried to work with them, tried to make sure because we had an investment in the properties that they didn't lose the property, tried to work with the lenders to modify loans. I tried to go through that whole process for about a year and a half, 2 years, and I got so frustrated dealing with the modification companies and dealing with the lenders and trying to stop the foreclosures that were going on with the properties that I was involved with indirectly or directly that I started writing the book. And I tried to look for ways that we could save the homes. I tried to look for ways that we could turn around and help people move their home if they couldn't move it the conventional way. I tried to help people that had ruined and lost their home but needed another home to move into. How could they get back into the real estate market? So that was the book, the basis of the book. And to help the people understand what a short sale is, what a modification is, what a what a foreclosure and bankruptcy is, what are they? Because a lot of these people were forced into these situations and really didn't know what to do.
And so what kind of advice do you give in your book?
Well, it's a combination of advice. It kind of tells why we got into the situation we're in. Then it kind of tells you the pros and cons of owning versus renting, which is kind of it's a long standard of why you should own versus renting. And then the last part of it, or the main part of it, is basically 7 or 8 ways of dealing with the situation that they might have, whatever is related to them. If they're going through a short sale right now, what they have to do, what to look for, the frustrations involved. If they have to declare bankruptcy, what to do and what to look for. If they're being foreclosed on, not only from the standpoint of what the lender is going through, but what they need to do to be more prepared and a little more offensive instead of defensive.
I like that. I'm always, you know, my friends always say I'm such a crazy driver. And I say, well, you know, everybody else out there is driving defensively. Somebody's got to drive offensively.
Yeah. You know what? Because I knew a lot of these people. I've lost millions myself because I had investments and investors with the people that just ended up walking away from the houses. And at some point, we couldn't take the house back even because it had gone down so low that we had to just walk away from our investment as an investor. Because at first we tried to take them back and let the people live there and see if we could do something. But as the values kept declining, at some point we could even hold on to the property because they didn't even pay for themselves if the people left, you know. So it was a very hard situation. It's starting to turn around now, and there is a light at the end of the tunnel, but you really have to get through the frustration part of it if you're a consumer. And if you're a buyer out there right now, you know, you have to really know when you're going to buy something, are you prepared to buy? Are you getting in over your head or not getting in over your head? And the last part is, are you really getting a good buy right now? Like a lot of people think a year ago, 2 years ago, these investors would come in and say, hey, I'm buying at 60 cents on the dollar. I'm making a killing here. And they buy 5 houses at $250,000, those houses today are worth $180,000. So did they really sell those houses? You know, we don't know.
Right. Well, you know, I think we're going to have a double belly flop here with all of this strategic defaults going on, because all the people that did things right the right way and that can afford to service their mortgage, but because they're underwater and they have other financial goals in their lives, they're choosing actively to walk away from their properties. I think we're going to see another little value bounce here coming up because
You're exactly right. First of all, the innocent party that struggled to pay their payment but saw their values just decline tremendously because 7 of the houses on their block are in foreclosure. The values have gone down tremendously. They have no control of the values going down, but they're still being forced to make their payment. Secondly, like you said, sometimes it's easier to walk away from something because you could go right down the block and rent for $1,000 less the same house that you're living in, you know. And then there's another wave of foreclosures coming because the jumbo loans that did adjustables 5 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, are coming due. And a lot of those homes are so far underwater, the high-end homes, there's going to be another wave of foreclosures.
I know. And, you know, we here in Arizona have, you know, an interesting thing with our marketplace because our value rise was started because of a scarcity of properties. We had really low inventory starting out in 05, at the end of 04 and 05. We only had like 8,000. We usually have like 32,000 on the market. And we only had 8,000. We got so low. And because of the super ridiculous values in California, all of that investor money kept pouring in here, and they were freaking out, going, wow, it's so cheap, even though they were overbidding properties by 20 or 30%.
Sure. Yeah.
It was cheap to them. And I'm like, I had just barely typed in and submitted a property to the multiple listing service. It was an entry-level condo in a kind of not-so-nice part of town. And I had 40 offers within 30 minutes. Nobody even checked the lockbox. I had not one lockbox check-in, but I had over 40 offers. And they were ridiculous. I mean, some of these real estate agents, if I was their broker, I would have fired them on the spot for writing some of these things. We'll go $500 more than the last guy.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, just silly stuff like that. And everybody says, well, when are we going to get back to where we were? And I said, Arizona should have never been where it was.
Yeah.
Our median home price was so far out of whack of our median income.
Well,
and we're not that kind of a state that can sustain those values.
I'm a broker in Nevada, which Arizona, a little bit the same. California
mm-hmm.
also, and New York now. And
Big service economy states.
Yeah, and California, I could see, you know, certain parts of the Bay Area and Los Angeles and San Diego, values were going up, and they were continuously going up by every year by 5%. Now, some years they had a dip, too, with the economy in the 90s and stuff like that. But when a state like Arizona or Nevada or whatever, with, like you said, they had low supply, and then all these builders got into the act and built, and like you again, from states like California and other states that were pretty wealthy, that was a steal, the houses in Arizona and Nevada and whatever, so people were just gobbling them up, overbidding and everything else. Now all these builders are out of business. All these houses that were built or declined by, what would you say, 30, 40% in Arizona?
Oh, some are more than that. Some are at half or more.
Okay, and
you know.
So you're back to what, about 1990 prices now?
Yeah, like, you know, but I don't know why. I mean, I remember, you know, I bought an 1,800-square-foot home in 93, and I paid $100,000 for it, and it was a townhome, but it was in a really nice part of town that I wanted to live in, and my goal was to move as far away from my mother without leaving the city as I could. So I figured she wouldn't drive out there and annoy me if I moved that far away. And, just kind of serendipity happened, and, you know, I wound up getting a divorce, and I sold that thing way more than what it was worth. I sold it at, like, $330,000. It was absolutely crazy. And it needed work by the time, you know, I got, you know, rid of my husband and stuff. I was going to stay there, but it was just too uncomfortable for me. So I said,
but,
you know, I got to get.
I think what you just said, you know, to analyze that, a house is a place to live, unless it's an investment, unless you're doing 10, you know, buying
right.
commercial stuff and investment properties, fourplexes, whatever, then that's an income approach. And then also long-term values going up. But a permanent residence should be something that you buy and you live in, and whether you live in it 10 years, 5 years, 20, 30 years, like in the old days, it was a place to live with some tax benefits and building up some equity for retirement, you know.
Yeah.
It wasn't a quick...
In 10 years, I tripled my money, and now it's only worth like $130 to whoever's living there now.
But if you would have kept that house, you made
mm-hmm.
out, you still would have been
yeah.
$30,000 ahead plus all the tax benefits you got over the years.
Oh, no question. No question.
So you still would have been okay.
Right.
Yeah.
And
no,
I put 10% down on that house,
yeah.
too.
Yeah. So my book really goes in now for the situation we're in and says, how can the people who are upside down, you're okay if you bought back in the 80s and 90s and you had your house and you didn't over pull out money, you're still okay. But if you bought from 2004 on, 2002 on maybe, you're upside down. Unless you put a tremendous amount of money down in most parts of the country. And most people refinance their house, got equity lines on them and everything else, so they're underwater. And the lenders don't know what to do. They don't want to even foreclose anymore. They don't want the houses back anymore. So
so they can't get rid of the ones they have taken back.
And my book addresses how to approach maybe holding on to the house and getting your payment down. It approaches if you've hurt your credit, which 40 or 50% of the people out there have hurt their credit, how to get back into the housing market, because a lot of these people are still make $100,000+ a year, husband and wife, and if they rent, they have no tax benefits whatsoever, so they're getting killed income tax-wise.
Mm-hmm.
By my contract-to-sale program, they can get back in because they can work with somebody that has a house to go in and have a five-year contract to be able to reestablish their credit and get some tax benefits. So
but I thought HUD is changing that deal now that you have to have your mortgage broker license in order to do a carryback like that or a seller financing.
Yeah, and again, that's probably good. That's good for people, you know. But you know, as a realtor, you mean your mortgage broker license to do a transaction?
No, if you are the seller doing seller financing,
right.
HUD says that you now have to have your license to be a mortgage lender in order to do seller financing.
I haven't heard that law. Is that a past law?
Yeah, 2 years ago, and it's just starting to creep up now. I think now is when it's going into effect.
So a seller, an individual property owner who is a seller.
We had a guest on a couple weeks ago that talked about it.
Is it state, the state, or federal?
So it's supposed to be federal. It's from HUD. So.
Boy, I don't know how they could get into property rights of somebody who wants to sell.
Well, that's his big fight. It's like you can't get into property rights like that.
Yeah,
you can't jeopardize and encroach somebody and tell them what they can do and can't
sure.
do with their property,
yeah.
which is kind of a stressful deal. So what would you say, so in your book, you know, if somebody wants, if they're underwater, what kind of, can you give us like a couple of quick steps
sure.
that somebody can do to save their house?
Sure. There, in the book, it discusses a lease option conversion program. Now, most lease options don't work, you know, on a normal basis unless somebody's selling their property and then needing time to go and buy somewhere else, and so they option to buy it. But with the market being what it is and so many houses, you know, left abandoned, or if they're rented out, they're not paying the payments, the poor owner of the property is, you know, probably got a negative of $500 to $1,000 a month, and that's just a matter of time they're going to lose the house. What they can do is lease option it off on a conversion plan. Basically, what is a combination of a lease option, which is a normal lease option, and my equity share program, so that the seller of the house can work with the new person coming in. The main thing is that lessee, the person that wants to live in the house, will pay most of the payments, you know, within reason, so there's not a big negative. And then over a five-year period, and we don't know where this economy is going to go in 5 years, so what values are going to go up, we don't know at this point. We're years ago, you could say it's going to grow by 2% a year. Right now, would you say that there's not going to be any growth for about 4 to 5 years?
Yeah, well, because I'm still waiting for the shoe to drop in the commercial market.
Yeah,
banks
right,
aren't letting those commercial loans go bad, even though they already are, but they're not defaulting them and moving on that process, and that's hindering the recovery, in my estimation.
Sure, and that's going to happen. It's happening here in New York. Owners of buildings are, I mean, all the people that have leases, the small ones have walked away, and the bigger leases are subleasing out portions of their lease to other people, and landlords have become so much, you know, compared to before, and I haven't been here forever, but giving away concessions and everything because the commercial market is just getting killed here. There's so much vacancy, and the owners of the buildings can't cover the overheads, and you're right. This is, a lot of the lien holders are going to start calling these. They're not doing it because they know it's going to put further pressure on the economy. Plus, they don't want to foreclose. They want to work it out. But so my lease option conversion allows for a growth period and that the owner of the property will make it so the lessee, can, as long as the lessee pays and makes every effort, be able to own that house at some point because it'll help both of them. He'll work with them and be a participant in a joint ownership down the road. We're having a lot of people now calling me and wanting to buy a property and would like an equity share investor to go in and buy because most lenders are going to require 10 to 20% down, and people don't have 10 to 20% down. And investors are looking at the market right now. The only thing that's hurting them is if it's a 10-year equity share, there would be no problem because they would gain on their investment. But short-term equity shares aren't going to go over because there's not going to be that much growth.
Mm-hmm.
You're getting a lot of investors looking, and the investors are coming out of self-directed IRAs and that where they've lost in their investments, and now they don't mind taking $20,000 or $30,000 and going into investments. I have a company in New York, B&B Real Estate Associates. I'm a broker, and I own the company with some other people. And the company is also got a company in Florida. I'm not that familiar with Florida, but the type of investments I used to do in Nevada and other places, it was triple net leases. You know, we'd go in and buy a building and have the owner lease it back to triple net. So there was no negative or anything, and it was growth. Now in Florida, we are buying up properties. The bank has taken them back for $50,000. We negotiate to buy them for $30,000, and then we put a person in there either on an equity share after we bought it. Now we buy it at $30,000 and probably put about $6,000 or $7,000 in to, you know, spruce it up and everything. At that point there, it's worth about $70,000, but we can lease it out for $1,200 to $1,500 a month. So that's a tremendous return on a $30,000-$35,000 investment. These, we're not talking about big money, you know, but it's a safe investment because you own the property cash.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of investors want to look at how can we get into the investment field right now. And you, I think I was listening to your program before I got on, and you go down to Florida and some of these people are buying up, you've seen it on TV, these were $800,000 condos and they're getting them for $200,000+. You can't even build them for that. You know. So there's investments out there as second homes and investments that you can do, but the lease option, working with the owner conversion program, will work. The equity share will work. The contract to sale will work. I will look into about the HUD thing that you said because I wasn't familiar with that, and I will look.
Yeah,
into
I just tweeted a link about it. HUD may limit seller financing. It's on the books. If you just Google seller financing HUD, a ton of stuff comes up on it.
But you know what? I think we're getting to a point, and you know as much about this as I do. We're getting controlled. I come from Canada, you know, originally. I was born in Canada, and I left there when I was 18, 20, but I would go back and visit my mother. And it's like socialized medicine or socialized this, whatever. We're getting to a point, and part of it had to be done to correct everything that was going wrong. But just think about what we just talked about, that they go into individual homes. Say somebody owns their house free and clear and says, you know what, in this market, I'd rather have the cash coming in instead of, you know, selling it outright, and I want to create the financing on it, and they can't do that with their personal residence.
Mm-hmm. Only to family members.
But that
but
would
you
be,
can't do it to a complete stranger.
Yeah, you know what that would be? That would be where there would be no free enterprise with real estate or anything else to be able to, you know.
But that's ridiculous to dictate that.
Yeah, why would you want to own real estate? If you put a restriction, I'm an investor and I'm going to go out and invest in properties and I'm going to do everything right by the law, what would be the advantage to me if I'm going to be dictated to of what I can and can't do? I mean, the government is throwing credits at everybody right now trying to entice them to buy. But if on the other hand, they restrict everybody, it's gonna even be worse in the long term.
This is Atlas Shrugged playing out in the real estate market.
Yeah,
all
I
can
right.
say. But, well, it was a pleasure to have you on. If somebody wants to buy your book or visit your website, how can they do that?
It's www.futureofrealestate.com.
Ooh, I like that. Futureofrealestate.com.
We're going to be doing some seminars around the country too. So if anybody wants to, and can I give out my email?
Yes.
Okay.
Certainly.
I'm sorry. That's the future. It's Ken, K-E-N, at myfinancialconnections, plural.com. So it's Ken at myfinancialconnections.com.
Great. And for those of you who are just driving around, we will have links on our website to all of Ken's website and to his email. Thanks so much for joining us again, Ken. And we will have more of Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio coming up right after this.
Stay tuned for the second half of Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio with the Keys to Riches right after this. Like, has your cell phone or iPod ever totally run out of battery before? Maybe you're somewhere without power, like fishing, camping, or the beach. Now you can have all the power you need. The K-Free Charger by Kinesis Industries uses wind and sun to charge your devices anytime, day or night. Use the wind and sun to store up charging power, or charge your device right on the spot. Available now! For $99.95 at www.kfreecharger.com. KinesisIndustries.com. That's Kinesis, K-I-N-E-S-I-S, Industries.com. Like, go there, totally.
Hi, this is Melanie, and I'm part of Two for the Road USA. I'm the X from Boomer and X. I've been test driving cars for several years, but in the last 18 months, I found it difficult to get in and out of the test vehicles. I kept complaining the manufacturers didn't make the seats large enough until I realized it was me who was too large at 220 pounds. Thanks to the Duradori weight loss program, I lost 50 pounds. The Duradori program is physician-supervised, non-surgical, safe, and effective, and you can lose up to 5 to 10 pounds the first week and 15 to 20 in a month. I did. It controls hunger and trains your body to burn fat, all on an easy-to-follow regimen of exercise, hydration, and delicious, healthy eating. It is a three-phase program combining medication, nutrition, and exercise. This is an affordable program with counselors available at any time. I went from a size 20 to a size 10 in 7 months, and I feel like a different person. Check out my photos on twofortheroadusa.com. Click on Watch Melanie Lose Weight on Duradori. Call Duradori now at 480-661-9662.
Karen Gurm here. You probably recognize me as your segment host for News by the Numbers. Did you know I am also one of the certified NLP practitioners and a financial coach here at the Unlock Your Wealth Foundation? The most successful people in life have coaches to guide them along their chosen path. Tiger Woods, Michael Jordan, Tony Stewart, Tom Hopkins, Robert Kiyosaki all had coaches. Whether it was their father, someone else's father, or another person who helped them to shape their desires into an achievable path to success with a system of accountability where quitting was the only way to fail. Each of these people had someone who didn't see them as they first were, but as the person inside they knew they could easily become. Financial coaching can be the single addition you need to become financially independent. Call the Unlock Your Wealth Foundation now for your free consultation. 1-866-966-9420. 1-866-966-9420. Or visit us on the web at www.unlockyourwealth.com.
Even in today's economy, I, Count Dracula, have had to foreclose on my castle. But because of Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio, I have not only reacquired my castle, but I have opened a resort for the undead. Tune in to Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio. She's the only one not trying to suck you dry.
Welcome back to the broadcast, everyone. You are listening to Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio. You know what time it is? It's that time again for our Millionaire Minute. This is the segment where we crawl into the heads of top millionaire thinkers and put out 60 seconds of tools that you can incorporate into your life right now today. How about two defensive strategies and one offensive strategy? Defensive strategy number one, millionaires say a penny saved is a penny earned. Build your wealth by defending the money you have now. Defensive strategy number two, millionaires say stop frivolous spending. Do you really need a $4 Starbucks coffee? Do you really need to buy lunch at the cafeteria? Look at all the ways that you spend your money each day and decide, do I really need this? An offensive strategy number one, the key step to building wealth is frugality. While defending your wealth is important, of equal importance is building your wealth through an offensive strategy. Look for ways to take on more projects at work with greater visibility that may land you a promotion. Once you have saved and looked for ways to generate extra money, the next step, offensively, is to start by investing your money. You need to make this a lifelong process. Now, fully and completely integrate these habits now. See yourself in this way. Look forward into the future and watch how differently people will respond to you. Imagine yourself with these successes already. Create some affirmations with these tools as well.
to reinforce what you have just integrated into your personality. And that's your Millionaire Minute. Now, for the final time, I can't believe I'm even saying that. Sounds so kooky. But, let's bring on Karen Gurm, shall we? Have a little chat with her.
It's a need you gotta fail. It's news you gotta know. And news by the numbers is your favorite part of the show.
Yeah!
Welcome to the broadcast. Karen, are you there? Hello? Maybe she quit the show already. I don't know where she is. I think her mic is live. Karen. Okay, well, she'll come back when she comes back, I suppose. Maybe she didn't want to do the news by the numbers one last time. Who knows? So what we have coming up next is, let's do one more news by the numbers while we wait for Karen and see where Karen is and so forth. Are you there now, Karen?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, okay.
I was here before. I don't know. That was weird because you're like, welcome. I'm like, hello, hello.
I'm like, no, Karen, where is she? So I'm so sad, dude. How do I say that without just being direct?
I know it is. It's so bittersweet. I'm very sad to leave, too.
But I'm excited for you. You're going to get to do what you've wanted to do. Not that you haven't been doing it for us, but you're going to
mm-hmm.
have expert tutelage, and you're going to get resources that I was unable to provide for you to help you with what you want to do in life, and that is being the most fantastic PR person ever, which I already thought you were, but...
There's always room for improvement, but I'll just learn everything I need to learn and come back and work and be even more fabulous.
Yes, that sounds great. That's what Fred said. He says, she'll be back. Don't worry. So I hope he's right. Well, I think that the stock market's been trudging along nicely. What happened this week?
Well, I thought it would be fitting to talk about what was going to happen in the future with the stock market, so my report is geared towards that, but yes, indeed, the stock market has been tracking along. Stocks ground their way to reasonable gains for a third straight week, despite a higher dollar and hits on oil prices and shares of smartphone maker Palm. The Dow, the NASDAQ index, and the Standard & Poor's 500 index hit new highs from the March 2009 bottom this week. Indeed, the Dow ended the week up 64% from the 2009 bottom, with the S&P 500 up 71% and the NASDAQ up 87%. So the gains alone suggest the market is ready to slide. Though the week did finish with a bit of selling, the Dow Jones Industrials finished down 37 points on Friday to 10,742, although they ended up 1.1% for the week. It was the first down Friday in 4 weeks for the industrials, and it's set up next week as a potentially volatile stretch. There may be bullish reports from such companies as Best Buy, Oracle, but the economic reports can easily move markets. Chief among the economic reports are those on housing. Existing home sales for February due Tuesday from the National Association of Realtors, and home prices for January from the Federal Housing Finance Agency, also due Tuesday. There will be a potential fallout from the weekend's congressional voting on health care reform, and don't forget to watch what's going on in Greece, India, and China. And that is your news by the numbers for the week.
Thank you so much for that insightful report and for forecasting for next week and the things to watch for. And we hope you drop by from time to time and check in and say hello.
Of course I will.
You've had a Saturday routine now for a year.
I know. It'll be weird. I'll have to call into the show. I won't know what else to do with my Saturday morning.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for everything you've done. And we're such a shining star here. We're now number two in the finance category at Blog Talk Radio, and that's a direct result of all of your efforts and your belief in our mission here to create financial literacy for everyone. So I'm grateful to have had our time together, and I'm excited that we get to continue along as friends now. So that's nice.
Absolutely. Me too. I'm so thankful for all of the work I've gotten to do with the Unlock Your Wealth Foundation.
It's been great. Well, we wish you the best of luck in your future endeavors, and we hope to see you again sometime very soon. Now, we have ready and waiting for us the ever-popular effervescent, for a guy, I suppose, our Unlock Your Wealth protege for the show, Stephen Light, famous NASCAR race car driver Stephen Light, who has been chronicling his trials and tribulations financially as he struggles to find a sponsor for this year. So let's check in with him and see how he's doing. Here we are yet again in the Unlock Your Wealth protege power moment. Our Unlock Your Wealth protege, famous NASCAR race car driver Stephen Light, is joining us to check in on his financial coaching progress. Stephen, welcome to the broadcast.
Thanks, Heather. How's it going?
Things are going very well. I can't believe we're almost through with this season. Our radio season. You've still got a long load of racing to do. But as far as our financial coaching is concerned, we're kind of winding down. We're almost done. And this week's key is review, revise, and recommit. And while we've come so far, and last week we adopted yet a new philosophy to forget the perfection principle, and we're going to focus on our progress on the process and be patting ourselves on the back for that. However, what happens if some of the things that maybe have taken us off of our game and knocked us off of our savings and spending plan might need to be changed because we're no longer meeting those commitments that we made to ourselves? We are unable. This isn't about unwilling. We are unable to continue along that plan. This is where diets fail, and this is where budgeting fails. Because you have to do the same thing over and over for a period of time. And while initially we might see some savings, and initially we might see some weight loss if we were dieting, what happens is that plan only works for a while, and then we plateau. And then when we plateau, we get discouraged. And then during that plateau is when maybe we cheat or we fall off the wagon completely. And we just give up. And financial money management is a process. It's not a one-size-fits-all, and it's not a do this over and over and over, and this is what your results are going to be. Because life changes. Whether we change or not, or whether we're willing to admit change happens, life changes. Circumstances change. And like we talked about last week in Forget the Perfection Principle, the loss of an income-producing spouse, maybe somebody becomes unemployed or disabled on the job, maybe we have to take on the care of an indigent parent, or maybe we had an unexpected birth or addition to our family that we weren't prepared for. So that changes the game for us. And in order for us to be successful with money management and to be able to create our future financial independence, we need to be able to identify what has changed, and then we have to make necessary corrections for us to still stay focused, keeping our eye on the goal, while being able to manage what's going on in front of us so we can still hit that future goal as well. And that's the beauty of this plan versus other plans where you just kind of put a system in place and just do it over and over and over. And what we want to do here is take a look at and review what we have accomplished. Where have we come from? What is working and what isn't working? So as you look back over this last period of time since we first started our planning process, what did you find or learn that has worked for you so far?
The biggest thing, I think, is we talked about this 2 weeks ago, I believe, was you know, one of the biggest money problems I was having was eating out all the time. And I think I've really gotten control over that. I actually took a peek at how much I, on average, was starting to save during the week, and there were some weeks I would save almost $300 just from not eating out and eating at home. And I found I couldn't believe how much I saved on it. And I think the more it started off, you know, $100 a week or $150. But as I saw that the first couple times, I was like, once you see that, it's like easier almost. You know, you see how much you save at first when you're just barely starting to try and save. And then the more I did it, the more money I saved and the easier it got. And that transition just seemed to kind of take off for me. That and, you know, other little things that I've seen some improvements on, but that's probably been the biggest improvement I've had over everything else.
Isn't that exciting when then saving, like when you really start to see some momentum and then it like becomes a game, like, ooh, how can I save somewhere else? Ooh, how can I pile up more money somewhere else?
Yeah, it starts to become more of a fun thing rather than something, or, you know, rather than a necessity or something you have to do.
Oh, I like that. I like that. Well, I'm glad that that's been able to benefit you. That was a big hurdle to overcome, too, because, you know, a lot of us feel entitled to just, you know, go out and, you know, you throw down the gauntlet sometimes financially and you say, well, this is what it is, and I'm only going to be this way. And then financially your picture changes and you have to make adjustments if you're going to survive financially. And I champion you for being able to incorporate that, because that's a toughie for people to incorporate, to make big lifestyle changes like that. And that's a difficult thing to overcome, and you've done very well at that. Can you think of anything else along the way so far that you thought, you know, wasn't an issue, but maybe it is now, that you might have to change or tweak something else again?
You know, I think one thing I looked at was gym membership at the place I go to in Birkdale. It's not necessarily super cheap. And, you know, I looked at, and also my race, you know, at first I thought there was an easy fix to that, was my race shop has its own gym indoors at their shop. I thought, well, what if I just started working out there all the time and you know, got rid of the pain completely? Well, the only problem I saw with that, finding out the hard way, was the drive from the race shop from my house is 1 hour and 15 minutes. And there and back, you know, every day, that's 2.5 hours of driving. The gas I was no longer saving on that trip ended up being almost as much as the payment per month for the gym membership here in Birkdale. So I you know, even though I couldn't figure out a way around that and to make that better, just the fact that I was able to think of all those ways and come up with an answer, not necessarily a solution, I was glad that I was looking at it that way rather than not even attempting at all.
That's so awesome, because so many people will cut out a coupon and save 30 cents and drive to the opposite end of town to the only store that sells it just to be able to use that coupon. And that is amazing that you were able to identify that savings wasn't a true savings, because your expenditure of gas money to get there and the wasted time. And you know what? There's only one thing more important to me than anything else is my time. In my mind, it's priceless. So So I want to be doing the most productive thing possible. And sitting in a car, driving for an hour and a half to work out does not make sense for me. You know, and for you to be able to identify that the cost outweighed the benefit of eliminating that gym membership was an amazing use of your resources that you've learned so far. And that's awesome. I'm totally excited about that. Now, some other things that we need to talk about with regard to the review, revise, and recommit key is how do we begin this process? The first part we must remember. Does that sound better? I was having some feedback issues. The first part we must remember is objectivity when we get started in our three R's. We must exercise our fifth key, take emotion out of the picture. So while we're keeping our passions in perspective, we're being excited about making money, but we're being conservative when it comes to spending money. So we want to put on that conservative hat and be objective when we start this review process. So that's the first step. Make sure that you are unfettered, so all the kids are doing something else. Nobody needs your time, because you want to invest some of your time in this analysis, because this is going to be key to you being successful long-term with the Keys to Riches program. And flexibility is one of our key pillars in neurolinguistic programming. And so this is where we're going to exercise flexibility when we do our review, revise, and recommit key. And it's so important that we're objective and that we're flexible, because that's what's going to give us the keys to the castle and what will give us the foundation for our success. If we are not objective or not flexible to make changes and tweak things when necessary, we're not going to be able to stay the course for very long. Just like in dieting, you know, you can only eat so many chocolate fiber shakes, and at some point you're going to fall off the wagon. And at some point, while you may have started to lose weight at first eating chocolate shakes, over time that dwindles as the body gets used to that. So you want to keep your body guessing. So you always want to be changing things up to maintain that weight loss. And the same thing goes with our budgeting, because like I said before, life changes. And we need to be flexible, and we need to move with change, or we need to precipitate upcoming change and make moves to accommodate that change. And that's what this key is all about. So what we're going to do is we're going to get everybody away from us that will keep us from being objective and being able to focus, and we're going to review our first R, and we're going to look at everything that we have done so far. Since we did our assessment and we created our plan, our healthy savings and spending plan, now we're at our quarterly review. And we want to look at what worked. We set some targets for our financial categories. Did we make those targets? Did we not make those targets? If we made them, great. By how much? Did we come way under our guidelines and estimations? Or did we just meet the goals? Or did we not even get anywhere near the ballpark? And if we weren't anywhere near the ballpark, what we need to do is whatever did work, we need to do more of it and keep that going. But what didn't work, we need to find out why. We need to understand why this particular category was off. Did we not estimate a large enough allowance for that category? Or possibly did some other factors outside of our control happen, like a raise in price? For example, if you typically spend $400 on childcare, and they raised their prices, and it's now $450. So that's why you weren't able to cut down in that category or meet that expectation. So as you're looking at your savings and spending plan, where is the why? Is the why external, or is the why internal? Yeah, I know I said that I was only going to have, you know, $100 a month for entertainment, and woo, doggy, did I go overboard at $300. If it's external and not within our control, we may have to adjust other things that we are okay with, that we are succeeding in, and we may have to cut those back a little more to make accommodations for necessities like childcare, something we can't get around. You know, if you're working and you need to have your children cared for, it's a necessary expenditure. So outside of shopping around for another facility to house and care for your children while you're working and maybe see if you can cut your costs that way, you're probably going to have to make a judgment, make adjustments to your healthy savings and spending plan. And that's the revision portion of the key. So as we look through and review every category, and we've got high fives, we've got good marks in many of those categories, because we came in at or under our expectation for that category, and we were able to create some savings and get some momentum with our debt reduction plan, if that's what one of our goals was, or asset accumulation, maybe that was one of our goals. What we also want to do as we're reviewing this is make sure that we review what our goals were, our short, mid, and long-term goals. And is our healthy savings and spending plan accomplishing those goals? If they are, great. If they're not, why or why not? And this is where the revision portion of this key comes in. Because not only do we have to take a look at things individually in each category, but we have to take a look at it from a holistic approach. And when I say holistic, I don't mean, you know, put flowers in our hair and sing kumbaya. I mean as an entire financial picture. We can look at each of the elements, but we need to look at it as a whole picture. And we need to say to ourselves, is this working for me as a whole? Am I getting closer or further away from my goals? Closer or further away? So if we're getting closer, hooray! If we're getting further away, we need to tweak what's going on. Before we tweak, we need to evaluate, number one, again, was it external or internal? And then, are these goals still worthy of me? Maybe circumstances beyond your control have forced you to change your goals. Maybe you were planning to start saving for a new home, but all of a sudden you're going to have a baby now, and you're going to have other expenditures. And so do I need to extend this goal? Do I need to eliminate this goal totally? Do I need to find another way to make this goal happen? These are all questions that we're going to ask ourselves when we are evaluating our savings and spending plan in relation to our short, mid, and long-term goals. So if we like our goals, we might just have to extend them a bit. If we still want to buy a house, but we've got this immediate concern of having a child and all the expenses associated with childbirth, that maybe I need to push that goal out a little further. So we're also revising our goals if necessary. Maybe our goals aren't as important as they once were because of circumstances that have changed that. Maybe we have to take on the care of an indigent parent. So maybe, you know, you're going to have to buy a home sooner than you thought, but you'll be able to have the added contribution of their income to help offset that. So, again, this is all just a process, and it's highly individualized. This is about you, and this is not one size fits all. This is how do we make this work for you. And then, finally, after we're through with the review process, we've made revisions. The most important key is to recommit ourselves to those goals. And that's going to take a few minutes because we're going to do it just like we did with Dreams with Deadlines. because we want to visualize in our minds what our goal is. We want to be able to see it, taste it, touch it, smell it. We want it to become as real as possible and as concrete as possible so it's ingratiated into our life, that everything we're doing is for these higher purposes, and that we convince that inner curmudgeon that, yes, these goals are still worthy of us, and you're trudging along, and you're going to make them happen no matter what. No matter how much adversity you have faced, shake it off. No matter how many times you've had to say no, shake it off. No matter how many times that you felt like you were close to making the grade but didn't and you fell short, don't focus on that negativity. Focus on what you did do. If you were a dollar ahead of where you were 3 months ago, that's a pat on the back. Because it's not just about accumulation of wealth. It's about defending what you have and reducing your frivolous debt. So if you were able to reduce your frivolous debt by one more dollar, if you were able to save one more dollar, then that means the plan is working. The plan is working. And you need to be thankful for that. This is not easy stuff. It's simple, but it's not easy. And this is a lifelong process, and unfortunately, we're not taught this. That's why that Minutes on Your Money about teaching your kids about money, I felt, was so important. Because if we were taught about money back then, and it would have been just a part of what we do, think about how much more successful we would be right now, if that were the case. How much further ahead would you be if you weren't learning how to manage your money at 32? If you had learned it at 2 or 10 or 13 or 23 instead of waiting until you were 32, okay? So we're not going to cry about spilt milk. That's done and gone in the past. And so that's my point of doing of saying that is it doesn't matter what happened. It's done and over with. It's yesterday's news. What we need to do is focus on what we did accomplish, and then we have to recommit to those goals. And that may require you to write some more affirmations. If your affirmations don't currently reflect what your current goals are that we did in Dreams with Deadlines, you need to work on creating some. We have to make a plan and work the plan. And we must be committed. So here's our chance to revise our plan and make sure that we tweak what is necessary. Maybe we raised some of our goals. Maybe we met our savings goal, and we're going to move that into some investment accounts. And now we want to up the ante because, like Stephen said, he got so excited with the momentum of the money he was saving. So instead of just saving and putting that onto something else, which is just reallocation of assets, it's not really saving, what we need to do is run now to the bank and get it in a savings account where it's earning interest. Or if it's been sitting in a savings account and you're ready to have a better return, so you're willing to take on some risk, now we need to talk to an investment person and get that money working for us. So not only are we working to accomplish our goals, so is our money. And it will be working to accomplish your goals. And the further you get, the more momentum you have, the better it feels as you get a step closer to financial independence. And remember, this isn't about getting rich. This is about creating freedom to do what you want when you want to do it. And that's what financial independence is about. It's about freedom, calling your own shots, creating your own destiny. It's not about money. Money is just a tool. We got to remember that's not our goal. Money isn't our goal. Financial independence and all of the great things that come along with that, like freedom, is what we're after. So what we need to do is take our goals, and if we don't have affirmations from our goals, we need to create some affirmations that get our goals in line and get what we're doing every day through our affirmation process and focus on how do we do this? How do we get where we want to go? And I think that today is a good time to talk about the affirmation process. We talk about it in the second key, in the first key, so you're going to kind of hear it twice. But we have acceptance and affirmation for our first key, and that's accepting where we are financially, whether we're starting out or starting over or somewhere in between. And then we're affirming our future success because we have to overcome all those years of programming. So we'll be talking about it again in another couple weeks, but I want to talk to you about the affirmation process and why it's so important. Your brain is the greatest superhuman computer ever in the universe. There is no faster or better computer than the human mind. It's instantaneous. It's powerful. And you know what? The brain never fails. It never fails. And you're probably sitting there going, what did Heather just say? The brain never fails? Come on, I have failed miserably sometimes. Well, let's evaluate that. Why did you fail? What were you focused on when you failed? Were you focusing on the failure or were you focusing on your success? Did you think you were focusing on success when you were actually focusing on failure? I love when Bill Thomason, who is my NLP coach, mentor, trainer, and he trained Tony Robbins, which is what's so fabulous about him. So I feel like I'm one away from the master when I'm with him. And what's so great about neuro-linguistic programming is the brain never fails. And I love when he says this phrase, we always get what we say we want. We always get what we say we want. The key word in there is say. And that's why neuro-linguistic programming is so important, because it focuses on language and the neural system in the body. Our ability to respond to things, our programmed responses, our innate responses. And language shapes the way we communicate. So if we take that as universal law, and words mean things, we always get what we say we want. That boils it down to perspective. Perspective and focus. So if I said to you, I don't want to be poor, and the brain does not acknowledge negativity, so all the brain is hearing, I, and they don't hear the don't, they hear the want, poor, poverty. So the brain is going to, on the sly, subconsciously, work to create that because that's what you said was its goal. I don't want to be poor. So it's going to do everything it can to bring you to poverty. You're going to get rid of all your money faster than it comes in, more than likely. You're going to be cavalier at best. You're not going to take any time to learn how to manage money because you don't need to if you're going to get rid of it. The brain is that powerful. And these have to do with all of our preconceived notions and our patterns that were set up by our parents and our peers as we grew up. We didn't have much to do with how our value system got shaped. It was shaped by others growing up, and that could be a good thing or a bad thing. And the only time they change is when we as adults get into such a painful situation that we can't be the same way we are, and then we have to change. So you're working like a dog, and you're just like one notch above poverty because why? And you say, I can't seem to get ahead. And what does that say? I can't seem to get ahead. So you take the no out of that phrase. Can't get ahead. Can't seem to get ahead. So I'm not going to get ahead. That's what you're focusing on. But if you say, I want to be financially independent, your brain has an idea or concept of what that is. It might not be super specific. That's why we work with our goal process. But just think of, I don't want to be poor, and I want to be rich. Do you see the difference? They're not the same. If you want to be rich, you need to say that. Because I don't want to be poor is going to keep you impoverished. They're two different goals. If you want to be rich, you must say that. Don't say, I don't want to be poor. Well, I don't need to be super rich, but I don't want to be poor. Well, many times we fall short of our goals when we go after them. So if we set our goals really high and fall short, we might be a further ahead of where we would have been had we not set our goals so high. So given that, let's take another corollary and say, all right, well, if I set the bar at 10 and I get to 8, I miss the mark. But I'm further ahead than where I was. Maybe next time I set the bar at 12 so I can hit 10. If we end up just under, if you say, well, I just want to be comfortable, and you end up just under that, that's going to be one step away from poverty. If you say, I just want to have, you know, Starbucks every day, I want to have enough money to have Starbucks every day, that's all you're going to have. And if you fall short of that, which most people do, it's going to be less than what you want. You're going to be settling for less than you expect. So you have to raise your expectations. My grandfather used to say that all the time, never settle for less than you expect. So if I want to shoot for something, I'm going to shoot for the moon, because if I fail and I settle on the stars, it's still probably further ahead than if I never decided to get out of this hemisphere. If I just shot for the clouds, for example, and I miss the clouds, I still wouldn't be where I wanted to be. So we have to re-up that emotional engagement. Now, we took emotion out of the picture to start the planning process and review, revise, and recommit. But in this recommit phase, this is where we want to bring emotion back in and passion back in. We want to illustrate in concrete terms how solid that our goals can really be and get reconnected with that. And, you know, make it so you can taste it, so you can smell it, so you can touch it, so you can see it. It's vivid. It has color. It has texture. It has movement. It has others in it. It has value, assign a value to it. And when you assign a value to it and it becomes important, then we can't not let it happen. That's how powerful the human mind is. But what you think about, you bring about. So if you're focusing on the negative aspect of a goal, instead of I want to be rich, and you're like, oh, I don't want to be rich because rich people are like this, and you have preconceived notions that are negative, you're not going to get there. You're going to avoid it. And if you focus on negative goals like, I just don't want to be poor. I don't want to be rich, but I don't want to be poor. Your brain's going to create that because it doesn't hear no and it doesn't fail. So you need to program yourself the right way. And after you recommit and revisit these goals and you create some affirmations, you need to use the 6 P's for affirmation success that we go through. And we'll go through that again in 2 weeks. And you've got to start filling your head with the things that you want. Don't focus on the things you don't want. And you need to make sure that you say what you want, not say what you don't want. Say what you want, because words mean things and your brain will focus on those words. Before language, we just had images in our heads and we couldn't communicate with people. And when we were able to create a language and identify a sound to something, now we were able to communicate. And now we think in terms of words. We don't think in terms of pictures as we get older. We think in terms of words. And so our words become vitally important, and we need to focus on that. So as we put this process together, over time, as we do this review, revise, commit quarterly, we can exponentially manage our results and our success simply by taking this quarterly snapshot and figuring out what we accomplished since the last snapshot, Are we closer to our goal? Are we further away from them? If we're further away, why? Is it a temporary poor decision-making why? Or is it a life-changing event why? And if it's a poor decision why, then you need to have a meeting with the man in the mirror and set him straight. Get back into your accountability process and master that state. So anytime these emotional decisions come up, you short-circuit them and you don't placate the victim inside and you become the accountable person and say, no, we're not doing that, and right the ship. Or if it is a life-changing event, how can I still keep my eye on the goal and make accommodations for this life-changing event? Because my life changed, whether I wanted to or not, and my life changed and my money probably didn't. And how do I manage this new life change? So all you have to do, Stephen, for this weekend is to take a look at your savings and spending plan and compare it to the one that we did when we first got started and answer those questions. Am I further away from my goals? Am I closer to my goals? Am I further away because I made poor choices or because I had a life-changing event? And if the answer is life-changing event, then you're going to have to restructure. If it's poor choices, then you're going to have that meeting with the man in the mirror. So you're prepared to do that?
Absolutely.
Great. So do you have any questions about this process? Or does it make sense why we want to do this review, revise, and recommit? So we stay in line with our goals, even though, you know, things change. Is it gelling for you?
Absolutely, yeah. It definitely makes a lot of sense. And look forward to seeing if I'm on the right track or if I'm getting further behind. But I'm pretty sure it's looking good right now.
Awesome. Okay, great. Well, good luck again this weekend, and we will check in with you next week for the last time. We're all done. Have a great weekend, Stephen, and we'll chat with you next week.
So now that we have assessed our mess, I mean, think about how far we've come, 12 weeks. We assessed our mess. We committed to action. We created a plan. We've worked that plan. And now it's time that we lift our noses from the proverbial grindstone and take a step back and see what we have accomplished so far. And remember last week's key about forget the perfection principle. This is about progress on the process. This isn't about perfection. So it doesn't matter where you came out. Yeah, of course, we want you to be ahead of the game from a quarter ago. But if you're not, let's just take a step back and evaluate and learn things. See where we are so we can review what's gone on, identify any issues, and revise those as necessary, and then visualize and recommit to all those great goals that we have that are worthy of us. And for this week's nuts and bolts, our key statement for this week is now that I am on the path to financial independence, I need to see how much I have accomplished or strayed from that goal. I need to see how much I have accomplished or strayed from that goal. I must decide if I need to alter my plan because I have new information. And I must make changes and recommit to financial independence. That's a big one. Now that I am on the path to financial independence, I need to see how much I have accomplished or strayed from that goal. I must decide if I need to alter my plan because I have new information. And I must make changes if necessary and recommit to financial independence. So that's your key statement for the week. Your key affirmation item is, I am great at reconciling my finances and recommitting to my goals. I am great at reconciling my finances and recommitting to my goals. Now, for those of you joining us for the first time, welcome to the broadcast. And simply put, the keys to riches is a baker's dozen of financial concepts that not only teach you how to think like the rich and be in control of your own money, but it also gives you specific techniques to create or fix your credit, reduce debt, save and invest, building wealth through real estate, all while transforming your current financial habits into healthy money management skills. So when we do our affirmations, you want to add this affirmation to your current affirmation list, or start one if you're new to the show. And again, this week's affirmation is, I am great at reconciling my finances and recommitting to my goals. I am great at reconciling my finances and recommitting to my goals. Now, when we say our affirmations, we say them several times throughout the day. The first time we say our affirmations is right before bed, and we read them out loud to ourselves to focus our subconscious mind on what it is that we want to bring to fruition, because an affirmation is a statement of truth. And so what we were trying to do is act as if it's already happening, so our brain has all night to work to create new neural pathways to have you act as if all of this is already happening, so it will help you get that much further on your path to financial independence. Now, after a fabulously restful and restorative night's sleep, we get up in the morning. The first thing we're going to do, no, it's not letting the dog out. No, it's not rolling over and kissing the spouse. It's you're going to pull out your affirmation sheet, because the first thing that you want to do before you start your day is now to focus your conscious mind on your higher purpose. Your higher purpose is not to let the dog out, not to kiss the spouse, not to get the kids dressed and fed and off to school. Your higher purpose is those dreams with deadlines. And so many times we can get caught up in the minutia of the day-to-day that we lose sight of what our goals are. That's why the recommit portion of this week's key is so important. So we are going to refresh our conscious mind of our affirmations. So we're going to say those to ourselves out loud so we can hear them, we can say them, we can feel them. We're going to be emphatic when we pronounce those words in those affirmations. And that is then going to focus our conscious mind on what our higher purpose of the day is, why we do what we do to get ahead. And it's to make all of those things happen. Now, what's important is what we think about, we bring about. And while we end our day and the last thing we do is say our affirmations, we know that we've controlled that by programming our brain to think about that all night long. But when we wake up after we say our affirmations, what happens? Oh, my gosh, now we start interacting with people. And we start moving about the planet and doing things. And what can happen once we start moving? Things can go wrong. Things or people can derail us from what we are trying to accomplish with our higher purpose. So as a result, we need to make sure that, again, what we think about, we bring about, we don't let people take us off of our game. And so here is the money. This is the money tip for today. When you're doing your affirmations, have them in your pocket, purse, or wallet. And any time you encounter negativity, we want to cast it back out, and we want to do that through reciting our affirmations. So after you have a negative encounter with a parent, a child, a spouse, a significant other, a coworker, a colleague, a customer, a client, some stranger that cuts you off in traffic, whatever it might be, once you have encountered negativity, you don't want it to stay inside you, because it will create dis-ease. Disease isn't something you catch. It's something you create within your body. So we don't want any dis-ease entering our body, and it starts with negativity. So we're going to cast that negativity out, and we're going to do it by using our affirmation worksheet. And we're going to pull out our affirmation worksheet after the negative encounter has gone on, because that's just fuel for that inner curmudgeon's fire. So then we're going to take and we're going to go through our affirmations yet again to cast out that negativity and bring positivity in your life. And let me just tell you that you might have to do that more than one time in a day. I know that I'm just thinking, could it rain any more problems today? Could I have any more issues today? And so I have found myself reaching to my affirmation list and going through it. After every negative encounter, I refocus myself, and I don't allow that negativity to take me off my game. So then I say that again anytime I encounter negativity. And some days you might be saying them more than not. But what the great thing is that repeated exposure drills it into your head. And as you go through these affirmations and your brain starts to create that what-if scenario for you, it'll be amazing. It'll be spectacular to see how folks will respond to you. You will change. It may be quick, it may be slow. It all depends on how your body integrates these new habits and these new thoughts and new feelings about yourself. But you just watch, mark my words, at some point, people will start to notice. And when they do notice, one of two things is going to happen. They're going to be threatened by you, or they're going to be happy for you. But in any case, people are going to respond differently to your fabulous new you, your positivity, your energy and enthusiasm for your goals. All of that will translate just with this simple affirmation process. It's so powerful. I challenge you to try it out for 30 days and see what happens. You'll be remarkably different, and everyone around you will be responding to you differently as well. So now that's our key statement and key affirmation item. Your key action item, your homework for this week, is to pull out all of your documentation for your savings and spending plan. Pull out your dreams with deadlines worksheet. Reread your goals, and then after you reread your goals, make sure you take emotion out of the picture and then start reviewing your finances. You're going to revise your plans if necessary, and recommit with enthusiasm and vivid clarity of those goals. And that is your homework. And then next week we just have one more key. I can't believe it. So I'm so excited about what we've got coming up. Next season we have so many amazing things to bring you. You're just gonna really flip your cookies and when you see what we've got in store for you. Again, farewell to Karen Gurm. Thank you so much for all your contributions to take us to where we are, and we look forward to seeing you again down the road. Thank you, the listener, so much for listening to Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio. We're so excited to bring it to you every Saturday at 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time and every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, where we talk about financial wellness and crisis management tools designed to help everyone, man, woman, and child alike, manage their finances and attitudes for the single purpose of achieving financial independence. I've been so excited that you joined us today. Thanks again to my guest, Ken, for talking about the real estate market and what you can do to defend yourself against these values. As always, we will join you. I'll look forward to chatting with you again on Wednesday. And enjoy your weekend. Make sure you get your review, revise, and recommit done. And we will look forward to chatting with you again next week. I'm Heather Wagenhall. You've been listening to Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio. Thanks so much, and here's to your financial independence.
I've had it up to here, listening to a small segment of people trying to put down America. America's the greatest land on earth, and we ought to be proud of what we have. I'm proud of America. I'm proud of our people, and I'm going to prove it. We're American and damn proud of it.
Frankly, I'm getting a little ticked off.
Go to hell.